Good morning, Your Honors.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please. Good morning. My name is Michael Bestie with the law firm of Reinhart Harper Davis. I represent the appellant, Carnell Carrington, in this matter. Your Honors, we had a brief hearing on this case, and there was a factual stipulation in the record at in the appendix at 21 to 22, which resolves just about all matters, all factual issues present before the deputy commissioner in Danville. In fact, the deputy commissioner even asked, so why are we here then? And the facts were settled. And the pertinent facts, the appellant, Mr. Carrington, had a pre-existing polycystic kidney disease, predated his 1992 hire with this company, worked there over two decades. In 2006, he had a kidney transplant in connection with this condition, and he had reoccurring appointments and treatment for this condition as well thereafter. August 13th, 2014, he has a compensable accident, an injury, injures his left arm, and he returns to a light-duty position. He's permanently, partially disabled, permanent restrictions and no use of his left arm thereafter. And he goes back to work 40 hours a week compared to the 50 to 60 before the accident. Stuff in envelopes. October 2nd, 2014, he's hospitalized for this ongoing polycystic kidney disease. And he has another kidney removed. Thereafter, Mr. Carrington filed a claim for ongoing temporary total disability benefits based on his pre-injury wage from that date of the hospitalization and ongoing, October 2nd, 2014. So why do the stipulated facts get us there alone without a hearing? Well, it's the two causes rule. So under and workers' comp.
Well, let me go ahead and ask you a question about that. Do we have two causes here? In that if magically there was no problem with his left arm at all, would he still be totally disabled?
If there were no problem with his left arm and he were released to full duty, factually he would be totally disabled in connection with the kidney condition.
Then explain to me how the left arm, the pre-existing left arm injury from a work accident, completely compensable, contributes one iota to his current disability. And I'm sure you know I didn't pull one iota out of the air.
And the case law will say that. It's not a high standard, Your Honors. One iota, 1% of his ongoing disability being related to the arm, it gets you to full benefits under the two causes rule. And I'd submit that the case law establishes that even with partial disability, while totally disabled for a pre-existing condition that the employer knew about, those TTD benefits, those temporary total disability benefits, are awarded. In counsel's brief, there was a glaucoma case. That was the case of Orange v. Tidewater Construction Corporation. There hasn't been a lot of cases on this topic. There's a handful of them, a lot of them at the commission level. In this case, the injured worker had pre-existing glaucoma. He was a carpenter and suffered a shoulder injury at work, returned back to work as a carpenter, and his shoulder injury didn't prevent that position. Though he had permanent restrictions, he could still do that job as a carpenter. The glaucoma progressed to the point that he could no longer be a carpenter. He couldn't see the fine lines to the extent that he could achieve that standard of quality that he could do before, and he was fired. And the commission held that Doan does not apply because the condition predated the accident and the employer knew about it. So in that case, there was a partial disability.
But was there a finding that he was totally disabled because of the loss of vision? Or was it just that he could no longer do the job that they had for him given his pre-existing partial disability?
He was not totally disabled. No doctor removed him from the workforce. However,
from the record here, could the commission have concluded that the kidney issue totally disabled Mr. Carrington?
I'd submit that the kidney condition factually did totally disable the Mr. Carrington, as he had permanent partial, he had permanent restrictions for his arm. He wasn't able to go back into his pre-injury position. And I think it comes back to the old legal maxim that you take your plaintiff as you find him. Same thing in workers' compensation. As a matter of fact, in workers' compensation, I'd submit that it's even more restrictive, as here the employer needs to know about that pre-existing condition, as set forth in Doan in 1985 by the Supreme Court.
Is the commission, as fact finder, all the case law talks about, we encourage stipulations, it's a good thing. And clearly, if the commission wants to hold you to a stipulation, no amount of evidence overcomes that once you've stipulated it. And that's our Jones case. Is the commission required to accept all stipulations, or can the commission as fact finder reject the stipulation?
I would submit that the tribunal is bound by the factual stipulations. If something is so outlandish and absurd that the evidence in no way supports it, perhaps that case could come down on that issue. But I don't think that's the case here. I think the facts support the very, very brief testimony that he had this pre-existing condition. He had this kidney transplant.
And I noticed regarding your second assignment of error that it was error to reject the stipulation. There wasn't a case that said that. That said that they didn't have the power to reject the stipulation if they didn't want to accept it. And we allow the commission to do all kinds of things. You can stipulate to a bunch of things in a settlement and they can reject the whole thing, even though the parties agree. And so I'm trying to figure out, do they have the power to reject the stipulation?
I didn't find cases, Your Honor, where they had the power to reject that stipulation. I think if...
Did you find one that says that they are bound against their will to a stipulation? Not that the party is bound by the stipulation, but that the commission is bound by the stipulation.
I did not, to answer your question. But I think you're getting dangerous territory if the parties stipulate to certain facts, don't present evidence on those facts relying upon that stipulation, and then it comes out the other way. For instance, average weekly wage issues come up all the time in workers' compensation cases, and if a second similarly or second employment that's substantially similar is tacked on and the average weekly wage is larger, the parties can compromise and maybe find somewhere in between, come to a good faith compromise and a factual stipulation. There may not be evidence in the record, and if the commission rejected that based on some evidence that they may have found or reasonably inferred, I think that it's dangerous. And therefore, if a good faith stipulation is presented to the commission, that the tribunal ought to be bound by that factual stipulation. I mentioned Orange, the glaucoma case, and I'd submit that Alonzo v. Dittmar, also decided by the commission and cited in the appellant's brief, is also quite persuasive. In fact, that case had a pre-existing back injury. Subsequently, the claimant suffered a hand and neck injury, or injuries. 3 years after that accident, he had a back surgery. Totally disabled him, like this case. Totally disabled him for the back surgery. Now, I'll concede it's dicta, because they found that ultimately that back condition was some way related to the work accident. But the commission said even if the conditions were unrelated, even if the back was unrelated, the application must fail. The commission held the employer accepted this employee with a pre-existing back injury and it remains liable for compensation until the employee has recovered to the point that the aggravation from the industrial accident has ended and the employee's back condition is the sole cause of liability. Similarly, in this instance, I would submit under the two-cause rule, as it doesn't fit the carve-out in Doan in 1985, that it would be the same circumstances, that total disability during the period in connection with the back injury would have warranted temporary total disability benefits. Despite the stipulations, In this case, the commission found that kidney failure, I believe that Commissioner Newman identified it as, arose after the accident. The commission relied upon the same cases that appellant relies upon in the brief. They're the right cases, and again, there's not a lot of them.
Does it matter that what Commissioner Newman and the full commission based its factual conclusion on was your client's testimony? I mean, you're asking that the commission be bound by a stipulation, but it was your client's own testimony that suggested that the kidney failure was essentially a new thing.
I would submit that I believe the testimony and the leading question was it a change in circumstances, which is a term of art in workers' compensation to suggest that those benefits should change. I'd submit with the appellant's education level and his other testimony that it's evident that that a company with Dr. Fredericks, the nephrologist, his medical evidence, which states that this is something that was progressive and which now totally disables the claimant. Certainly, there's many times in workers' compensation where deputy commissioners and the commission and this court of appeals are reluctant to rely upon a claimant's testimony with respect to a medical issue. Now, I understand that a claimant's testimony needs to be considered in that regard, but certainly the doctor's opinion ought to trump Mr. Carrington's brief response to a leading question with respect to whether that was a change in circumstances on that one date. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm John Johnson from Roanoke, and I stand for Aquatic Company and its insurer. We submit that the opinion of the commission is supported by the evidence and should be affirmed by this court. Mr. Besty said the facts are not in dispute, and in large part they're not. This was a case where the parties take the commission's endorsement of reaching consensus on issues before a hearing, and we did that. Procedurally, the claimant had his accident on August 14th, 2013. The claim was agreed to for injuries to the left upper extremity, and an award was entered and approved by the commission. The claimant returned to work in a light-duty capacity at some point in November of 2013 at his regular wages, receiving...
Do you agree that if the kidney failure itself is simply the natural continuation of the polycystic kidney disease, that we're in a two-cause situation?
No, Your Honor, I do not agree with that.
Why not?
Your Honor, the reason I do not agree with that is that if we take out the kidney situation, as I think Your Honor was positing during Mr. Besty's argument, and he is just working along in his light-duty capacity, then he continues to receive his wages, life goes on, all is well. On the other hand, if he has kidney disease, as he did, take the work-related accident out of the equation, it never happened. And he works and works up until the time and then has an unrelated incident where he has kidney failure, as found by the commission, then that is the sole cause of his inability to earn the wages.
Well, if we accept that kidney failure is something different, then how does that square, which the commission clearly found, mm-hmm. how does that square with stipulation number 9? Stipulation number 9 says the claimant has been unable to work due to polycystic kidney disease while at the same time partially disabled due to his work-related left arm injury, and that gave a date range of starting on October 2nd, 2014 and continuing. So that was the situation that the commission was faced with. That seems to say that we have stipulated that there are two causes to his disability, the partial left, the partial disability due to the left arm and his pre-existing polycystic kidney disease, and that's what's keeping him from working today. So how can the kidney failure be a new thing if that stipulation is binding?
Your Honor, I agreed with almost everything you said up until there's one phrase in there where you said, and total disability because of the partial restrictions.
Well, disability of some kind.
Some kind.
But it seems to me that you've stipulated that there are two causes to his disability, the kidney disease and the left arm injury. But setting that question aside, for right now, I want to focus on the kidney failure as a new thing, because that's what the commission found. They said it wasn't the pre-existing kidney disease. Kidney failure is a new thing. The stipulation here isn't that he's disabled because of a new thing. It's he's disabled because of the pre-existing polycystic kidney disease. It's not kidney failure as of October 2nd. It's polycystic kidney disease, which clearly is a pre-existing condition that the employer was aware of.
But what was the cause of his inability to earn the wages would be the position of the employer and the position they espoused from the very beginning of the case. And that's why, as we explained to the deputy commissioner at the hearing, that's why we're ultimately here, here being at the hearing.
Have you, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked him.
Yes.
Have you found any cases from the Supreme Court or this court, one way or the other, on whether the commission has the ability to refuse to accept a factual stipulation of the parties?
To answer that question, Your Honors, I have not found a single question that says it as neatly as you just did. However,
I'll take messy.
Messy, even messy. However, I would point the fact that 652705 states that the commission shall consider all the facts. And as we argued in our brief, the stipulation is not a set of legal blinders, if you will, where the commission is not permitted to look at the facts in toto, which is exactly what they did. And as this court noted just a few minutes ago, based its decision on Mr. Carrington's own very candid testimony that, you know, he was able to do the work, he was just fine working in a light duty capacity up until the change in condition, a change in the circumstances when he had what he called a kidney rupture. Was it a leading question? Maybe. It's cross-examination. Leading questions are permitted, number one, and number two, there is no record of any objection at the time that question was asked and answered at the evidentiary hearing. See, the commission found significant in making its factual findings that the claimant had 2+ decades of working with this condition in his regular job, which if the court reviews the transcript, they'll see that was by no means an easy job. I mean, it involved a lot of hard labor. Plus about, I believe, 15 months worth of the light duty work with the restrictions to the left upper extremity. Claimant's candid testimony established to the commission that he was able to do his pre-injury job. Contrary to the appellant's argument, the commission did not ignore the stipulated facts.
Pre-kidney failure injury job, the light duty job, right?
Both jobs, Your Honor.
Okay.
He could do, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, here we have a moving continuum.
Yes, sir.
He never was able to go back and do his pre-work injury job.
Not after August of 2013 when he had his injury.
So the commission found that he, that but for the kidney failure, he could have continued in the light duty job.
And that was stipulated to as well. You're correct. And the commission, they did not ignore the stipulated facts. The commission also did not ignore claimant's candid testimony that his inability to earn his wages in October 2014 was the result of the ruptured kidney. This court considers the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, my client. And if there's evidence or reasonable evidence to support those findings, then we would submit that this court should not disturb those findings.
Did the commission necessarily reject stipulation number 9 in reaching its conclusion?
I don't believe they've rejected it. I don't. I mean, the commission speaks through its opinions, and they considered it, but they considered the record in toto. In fact, they mentioned that, and they talk about having a broad sweeping application of Doan, a narrow interpretation of that. So from that, we can only interpret that they did consider that.
So from your standpoint, if the commission were bound to accept stipulation number 9 among the others, it doesn't hurt your case.
I'm sorry?
So am I to understand correctly that it would be your position that if the commission were bound to accept stipulation number 9, it does not hurt your case here today?
I do not believe that the commission is bound to accept any of the party stipulation, but if they accept it, and reached a contrary conclusion based on the record as a whole, in accordance with the statute, 652705, then I would submit that as correct.
Okay. So you don't argue that stipulation number 9 is consistent with the finding of the commission. You acknowledge that those are contrary.
There are some inconsistencies with the ultimate finding of the commission.
Name any consistencies.
I'm sorry?
Name any consistency between the commission's finding and stipulation number 9.
The inconsistency would be the stipulation that he is...
Can you tell me any consistencies between the two?
That he did have the condition, polycystic kidney disease, that it was disabling to him, would be consistent.
Except the commission didn't find that the polycystic disease, kidney disease, was what...
They found that the...
Kidney failure...
was the disabling condition.
As opposed to polycystic kidney disease?
Yes, sir.
But you stipulated just the opposite of that, correct?
The parties did. And the commission resolved the dispute in the facts presented.
Well, see, that's the problem. Is there a dispute if the parties agree? Now, obviously, in our opinion in Jones, we note that when a party to a stipulation objects that you shouldn't be allowed to offer evidence on the issue because you're stipulated, and the commission upholds the objection based on the stipulation, that's clearly binding. The question is, if it's inconsistent and binding, how does that not cause you a significant problem? Assuming those two things.
I do not believe that it causes a significant problem because we have the factual findings. The fact that...
If it's binding on them, can the commission find something that's inconsistent with the binding stipulation? That's the issue.
I think they can.
Okay, then how is it binding?
The commission is empowered to do full justice under the Act. I believe it's 652-200, which states that. And the commission, while it encourages the party stipulations, I mean, you could have a situation where an unscrupulous employer... And Mr. Bestie pointed to the average weekly wage issue, where an unscrupulous employer could base a claimant's entire average weekly wage on just a 40-hour week. He was paid 40 hours a week, when in fact, as in this case, the evidence was that beforehand he worked 50 to 60 hours a week, for which he received overtime. In that situation, the commission is free to do what's in the best interest of the injured worker and reject the party stipulations.
But I think the disconnect here is the foundation of my original question and Judge Russell's question then, is assume for purposes of the question that the commission is bound by the stipulation.
I would say that the commission is not bound by the stipulation in the context of legal blinders.
Our hypothetical is assume that they are bound by it.
Okay.
Does that ruin your position here today?
Ruins a hard word, Your Honor, but I would say that it substantially weakens it. But we still have the factual findings of the commission. And the fact that the appellate court may view the evidence differently, I do not believe that that gives the appellate court the right to undermine the factual findings of the unanimous commission below. And in that case, and that's precisely what the claimant is asking this court to do, is to retry the facts, reweigh the evidence, and disregard the claimant's own candid testimony at hearing, after the parties entered into the stipulations, which was contrary. So I would submit that the rules of appellate procedure provide that the commission's factual findings in its role as a fact finder, in its unanimous opinion, be affirmed and the case is over. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Besky, I believe you have some time remaining if you wish to use it.
Thank you. Your Honor, procedurally, the Deputy Commissioner below found it at the appendix at 303, quote, the defendant offered no evidence to contradict the assertion that the condition was diagnosed before the work injury and the employer was aware of the condition, end quote, which mirrors the stipulation.
But, however, but the Deputy Commissioner isn't the fact finder once it goes to the full commission, so.
Agreed. Agreed, though, I would submit that it is persuasive that the fact finder found in that way, but I suppose that issue at the full commission hinges again on the danger of rejecting that stipulation. That stipulation, which was agreed to before the hearing, wasn't rejected or there was no problem with it during the hearing or right after the hearing, wasn't argued in the written statement in which defendants appealed to the full commission. It wasn't suggested at that point that the stipulation should be rejected. It was sua sponte by the full commission in its opinion.
But if the commission finds that the facts simply don't support that stipulation, why can't they then choose to find in accordance with their judgment concludes?
Your Honor, I'd submit because the litigants entered the courtroom on that date with an agreement of a critical fact, several critical facts, which then evidence was not presented on those issues. Without that stipulation, evidence could have been presented on those issues, and we run into a judicial.
But wasn't evidence in fact presented? You've got your client that's cross-examined about, wasn't this something new and you've been working along the whole time? I mean, isn't that essentially calling into question that essential fact?
I'd submit it's not, Your Honor. I think we have an agreement that this is something that predated the injury. He was hospitalized on that date. Is that a change in condition? Factually, it could. To a layperson, was a hospitalization on October 2nd, 2014 a change in condition?
But if all likely necessary facts were covered by the stipulation, there would have been no need to put on testimony.
Correct. And I think that goes back to the deputy's question, so why are we here then?
Well, right, but given that it came up on cross, at least your client's partial response to that, why are we here, is so I can tell you these things. Because you put him on.
Agreed.
I assume there was some need to put him on or you wouldn't have done it.
To bolster the claim, Your Honor. To bolster the claim, which is admittedly cumulative. But one last thing I'd submit with respect to the very candid testimony of the claimant. At Appendix 47, he was asked, would he be doing light duty on an ongoing basis but for the kidney condition? He disagreed. He said no. Again, that goes against and contradicts the stipulation as well. I'd submit that this claimant's, not to impeach my own client, but sometimes we need to, and I'd submit that his testimony, his very brief testimony, is not what the case should hinge on. There's a lot of other evidence and stipulations to part. Thank you.
We'll come down and recap.